Order. Sounds like we got a sick group of people here. Not you guys. No, you're fine. Senator Jungbauer is out sick. Senator Kubley, Senator Brown. So everybody, you know, it's going to be sparse, but it'll be good because we have Senator Metzen here with us, and he's got all the important questions.
Madam Chair, I got my coloring book.
Yeah, today. He's all set. We've got him taken care of.
Who's guilty of that?
Today we've got the informational hearing on distributed generation, net metering. And with that, Assistant Commissioner Bill Grant and Mr. Brickweedy, if you could come up, please. Identify yourself, but you know this rigmarole. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, and with me is Peter Brickweedy, our Assistant Director of Legislative and Government Affairs. Thanks for the chance to address you on this topic. As you know, it's something that we've been spending a fair amount of time on at the department in the last several months, and so this is a good chance to bring you up to date on that work and give the committee more of an introduction to the issue. I'd like to start by just defining some terms because I think it's easy to get a little bit lost here, and specifically distributed generation and net metering. And these are two things that I think you're going to hear from me and from certainly some of the other speakers here this afternoon. Distributed generation simply is customer-sited generation. Typically, we think of that as on the smaller end of the spectrum, I usually think of it as something less than, say, 10 megawatts or so. So it's not large utility-scale projects. They tend to be much smaller. In fact, 10 megawatts would be a pretty large DG type of system. Distributed generation, I think another maybe area to clear up is not necessarily renewable generation. We have a lot of distributed generation on the system right now that's gas-fired, a lot that's diesel-fired. So there are a variety of fuel types that come into play with distributed generation. Net metering is, a subset of distributed generation. And in Minnesota, we have a number of small systems that are on a net metered rate. And essentially what that means is that when a customer sites generation, if they in a given month have generation that exceeds their own use, then they're able to sell that net generation back to the utility. And in some people's minds, that's like spinning the meter backwards for all of those kilowatt hours that you don't use but sell back to the utility. And in Minnesota, for a long time, we've credited those excess kilowatt hours at the retail rate. It's one of the issues that was very much a part of the conversations that we had this fall. The timeline on this really dates back to the late 1970s and the energy
crisis.
Mr. Grant,
could you just briefly talk about the fall meetings and just kind of give everybody that direction?
I'm okay. Getting there.
All right.
Just a quick timeline. 1978, the federal government passed the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act. That was the first federal law that required electric utilities to purchase qualifying generation from customers that cited their own generation. In 1983, Minnesota was the first state to implement net metering, and we at that time required that those excess kilowatt hours be credited at the retail rate. As of 2012, there are 43 states that have net metering policies of some kind in place. 38 of those net meter at the retail rate, and of those, 34 states have capacity limits. Ours is at 40 kilowatts. 34 other states have capacity limits that are higher than 40 kilowatts. And Minnesota is unique in that it is the only state. It's unique in that we're one of the very few states that pay at the retail rate. There are only a couple of others that do. While Minnesota was the first was one of the first states in the nation to implement a net metering policy, We really haven't had any major action on this since then, with the exception of interconnection standards that the Public Utilities Commission updated as recently as 2004. As a result of that, the Division of Energy Resources convened a series of workshops between September and November of 2011, really to discuss distributed generation and potential changes specifically to the net metering statute, since it had been a long time since we'd really looked at that. We had tremendous participation from all sectors of the energy world. We knew going in that making changes here would require buy-in from a lot of stakeholders. We wanted to operate in as transparent a manner as possible, hear all those viewpoints, and really look for where the benefits were across all the stakeholder groups. If there was one area of consensus coming out of that, it was that if we're going to make changes to the state's law, we really need to get the rules right. And since it's been a long time since we've really updated our rules, getting the rules right probably means that these would be the rules that would be in place for some significant period of time afterwards. So it makes sense to take time and do this right. We had four sessions altogether. The first of these three were topically oriented. The first was just a broad overview of all distributed generation, and that included combined heat and power, district energy kinds of systems, all types of fuels, what have you. The second session dealt with contractual and interconnection issues, and I think the upshot from that conversation is that there, again, we updated the interconnection rules in 2004. There's probably more that we can do there, but it's a very technical area and would require lots more conversation before we'd be ready to make changes there. What we did then on the and then the third session, I'm sorry, was specifically devoted to net metering and net metering policies. And then the last session, what we did was to divide the group up into 10 or so groups. And there were probably, since there were about 100 people there, there were probably 10 people or so in each of the groups, mixed across all of the stakeholder groups in each of the groups, and really had did a deep dive on all of the things that we had talked about in the previous three sessions and tried as best as we were able to pick up from those conversations what the themes were that people had in common, the things that people were most concerned about. And we then put out a summary of those comments and that stakeholder dialogue that we had, and received a large number of comments back in mid-January. And we've just yesterday posted all of those comments online and indicated to people that based on the process that we've held, based on the comments that we received, we don't think we're ready at this point to move forward with legislation this year. We do think that it would be worthwhile, however, to conduct a study with stakeholder involvement to look at issues of costs, both from a participant's and a non-participant's perspective. In other words, both those customers that are siting generation on their properties and the rest of the customers who end up having that impact them in some way or another. And look also at the benefit side of the equation. A lot of other states have found that there are reliability benefits. There's fuel price hedging that can be done with distributed generation. There are avoided transmission and distribution costs, diversity of supply. So there are a lot of things to look at, both on the cost side of the equation and on the benefit side of the equation. I thought, since we received a series of questions to answer from your staff, Madam Chair, that I would take just a minute to address each one of those, if that's okay. Starting with what are the goals that promoting DG is seeking to achieve. In our minds, there are several, and I think leading the list is customer choice. We've seen a fairly significant uptick in the number of utility customers around the state that have expressed an interest in generating their own electricity. It's for a variety of reasons. Some of them are clearly energy security reasons. They don't want to be subject to blackouts. They want to be able to control their own destiny when it comes to their energy use. For some, it's economics. It's simply too costly for them to ever be offline, so having distributed generation is important for that reason. For some, clearly, it's an environmental reason. They want to swap out the power that they're getting from the grid for what they view as a cleaner choice. Second, I think reason that we're interested in this is generation diversity. Any chance that we have to mix up the source of electricity that we're getting, the less vulnerable we are to changes in fuel prices, the availability of fuel, environmental regulations that are impacting other sources of electricity.
Mr. Grant, with that also, then you said earlier gas and diesel part of this, not just renewables. Would you include that then?
Madam Chair, we would. Now, clearly there's, like any other discussion about energy choices, there's a range from very clean to not as clean, and diesel would be on the not as clean end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have manufacturers of natural gas-fired distributed generation doing business here in Minnesota. Cummins and Fridley is a very large supplier of natural gas-fired small distributed generation systems.
So to that first question, then, what would you classify as a qualified generation type of source? What would that all include then?
Again, when we're talking about distributed generation, it includes all of it. When it comes to what qualifies for a net metered rate, that's a smaller list of...
That has to be renewable.
That has to be renewable.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
The final point I would make on, you know, why there's an interest in this and what goals we're trying to achieve is just the notion of job creation. There are not only on the renewable side, but on the non-renewable side, there's a fair amount of distributed generation equipment manufacturing going on in Minnesota, as well as the installation jobs that come with those systems. Second question that you posed, are there alternative strategies to achieve the goals that we're seeking to achieve with distributed generation, and what are those, and why aren't they adequate? I think we've tried a number of things, and a lot of them are still in place in one form or another. We've got production incentives out there with the solar bonus, with REPI, with other forms of production incentives. We've got project grants, the sort of grants that the Renewable Development Fund has done over time. We've got a renewable energy standard, although typically those what we've seen under the RES are larger projects, not smaller projects. We've got CBED, which was clearly an attempt to drive small generation forward in Minnesota. We've had trouble getting agreement around what the ownership rules ought to be under CBED. But I think the point is that we have put a lot of other strategies in place. And in our minds, all of them have certain pros and cons and are appropriate in some situations and not in others. Third question, is distributed generation consistent with the state policy of providing economic and reliable electric service, and what's the impact on reliability and economics from DG? I think this is a difficult question to answer because it really is case-specific. DG can enhance reliability when it's sited in the right places. DG covers, like I said before, a wide range of technologies and fuel prices, not just renewables. There are customers that are wanting to install DG do so for a whole variety of reasons, not just the cost advantages that might come with it. And the study that we're proposing to move forward with really is designed to try and address these questions about reliability and cost more comprehensively, which is why we'd like to move in that direction. Because we think we're going to need to look at all of those kinds of questions, not only at the customer level, but at the system level as well. Your final question deals with rate impacts of distributed generation on customers who don't install DG. And again, I would say that rate impacts is both on participants and on non-participants is something that we want to include in the study that we're planning. And to be clear, I want to have that include not just the cost side of the equation, but the benefit side of the equation. I think one of the things that's true in this case is that while we can quantify what some of the costs would be to non-participants, we also need to do a better job of quantifying what the benefits are in terms of reliability improvements, in terms of avoided transmission distribution costs. Some of those things really don't find their way into the cost-benefit analysis that we're doing presently. So with that, Madam Chair, be happy to take any questions sure. that you have, any additional questions. You
Hi, Mr. Grant. Is this study on the cost side and the benefit side, who's going to be all involved? Is it just the department? Are you going to have stakeholders there? Is it going to cost this committee any money?
What's
the time frame on
it? Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the question. First, to the stakeholder point, yes, we do intend to involve stakeholders. You know, I liken this to the study that we did before we passed the RES, the wind integration study, although at a much smaller scale. That turned into a huge endeavor involving lots of technical experts and so forth. I'm hoping that we can do this at a much lower cost and but be as robust as possible and involve all the stakeholders that want to come to the table on
And
this.
Who would that be,
Mr. Oh, well, after, you know, the experts in this area, I would include the utilities, advocates, and the customers, okay. And the businesses that have distributed generation equipment that they're trying to move into the market.
Okay. Cool. Pretty much everybody at the table.
Pretty much everybody at the table.
Yeah. Excellent. Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Minson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a, Mr. Grant, an estimate or the amount of megawatts generated by the DG?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, we do have a rough idea of that, and I subject to check. Xcel Energy has somewhere in the area of 8 to 10 megawatts online with all of its customers. Everyone else combined has about 1 or 2 megawatts.
Combined. Thank you.
So it's still
ways
quite
to go, Madam Chair, yeah.
Very, very small. And, yeah. And that's, again, one of the reasons that we wanted to look into this, because other states have surpassed that many times over, and we're seeing a lot more activity. We think that are the result of changes to net metering policies those states have enacted.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Benson, are you done? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Grant. The distributed generation, and I am sorry I missed your hearings this fall, but you included natural gas and diesel. So would that, for example, hospitals and data centers, business continuity plans have diesel, may have natural gas generators, so that's included in all of these numbers?
Director Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, no, I was including only those systems that were on a net metered
okay.
rate.
Like 30 of them there.
So, Director Grant, you really didn't answer my question, who's going to pay for the study? Can you absorb the cost?
Well, Madam Chair, we intend to pick up the cost of this and largely out of funds that we collect through the reliability function within the office.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Mr. Brickweedy, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Peter Brickweedy from the Department of Commerce. I would just add, I think from the department's perspective, we were, very grateful for the level of participation that we had from all stakeholder groups, including your staff, which was quite helpful to have all those folks in the room. And I think, as Deputy Commissioner Grant has indicated, we're looking at scoping out a small but technically robust study, and I think we're going to be looking to that stakeholder group to maintain a level of engagement with us, because it's going to be a big lift, and we need to have buy-in from across the stakeholder community if we're going to make changes. And we need to have a good exchange about what the costs are and what the benefits are. And so we're looking forward to continuing in that partnership with everyone, because we've had a really good set of conversations. We want to continue in a transparent manner that way.
That was a very good meeting you had this fall. I appreciate you doing that. That was very, very, very good. Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Brickwee. Thank you, Director Grant. Appreciate
Thank you, Madam
it.
Chair.
We'll have Mr. James Holtman from Runestone Electric Association. And I hope some of you had a chance to meet with your munis today. They were in full force. It was really good to see them this morning up in room 318. I know Senator Tomasoni was there and had him in stitches. He told some Iron Range joke. I'm not sure what it was, but it must have been a little tainted.
Can't repeat that one.
No, I had to leave the room. Oh, nice to see you, Mr. Holtman. Welcome. State your
Madam
name
Chairman.
For the record.
Unlike my predecessor, I am not an experienced hand at this, so forgive me in advance for any procedural blunders.
Yeah.
And I've made
we
my
just
first,
log, yeah, that's all. Don't
well,
worry.
Well, my first blunder was I've given out all the copies of my presentation, so I'm going to have to try to follow it as I go along. But what I was asked to do here is give a little bit of a background from the Rural Electric Cooperative perspective. I gave a similar presentation at the DER meetings this fall, which, by the way, I do have to compliment, thank you, Director Grant, on. Those were excellent meetings and a good opportunity to get a few things on the table that kind of need to be on the table. But I'd like to add a couple other things, too, as we go along here. There's really three key points in this presentation. Is first of all, kind of the overall role of co-ops and why we're here in distributed generation. And I'd also like to give you a sample of how Runestone Electric, which was my cooperative in Douglas County, Alexandria, Minnesota, kind of how we deal with distributed generation with our members. I think it's kind of important for you to get an idea of what that process is. And then, if you will, I'd like to express some concerns that Director Grant already addressed, but from the utility point of view, the cost shifting that happens naturally under any kind of distributed generation rules. Basically, the co-op's role is kind of significant. There's 43 co-ops in the state of Minnesota. I do not pretend to speak for them all, but we have a lot of things in common. A recent DOE study showed us that 83% of Minnesota DG is served by co-ops. Largely, that makes sense if you think about it. There's not a lot of wind turbines in downtown Minneapolis or even in the cities, so the co-ops are going to have a major role to play here. And we have more exposure to whatever policy comes along and to the existing DG policy. And the cost shifting, again, that Director Grant mentioned, is going to fall disproportionately on co-op members. So needless to say, that is our key interest here because, again, we are co-ops. We don't have investors, stockholders. The only thing that we really have to be concerned with is the members, which is good, keeps it simple for us. So we have to look out for the interests of our members. And it's kind of we're the key component in a lot of people's minds in the country. When they think of a wind turbine or something, they often come to the co-op and we get clobbered. There are very seldom does a week go by that I don't get at least a couple questions on distributed generation. So we see our role as to provide kind of an information source and support. We try not to be political. We're not pro. We're not con. And we're out in the community a lot. We give presentations to our own advisory councils, energy forums. We've actually held an energy forum specifically for that reason. Other co-ops have done the same. So we kind of view this as a responsibility. It's electricity. We are their electrical provider. We take that seriously. So pretty much anybody. I've got a political meeting Monday night. I can't wait for that one. Somebody from the Tea Party asked me to give a presentation on distributed generation. But we go to any group that asks us to go. And actually, they're really kind of fun because sometimes our DG members – go with us to these meetings. The people that actually have distributed generation go along, so it can be a real good time. But we also have an ongoing relationship. Right now, the members that I have that are on that have a DG system, a wind turbine, solar panels, or so forth, they work with me regularly. We provide supporting data. I'll explain that when I get into the presentation we give to members. And we help those members share information between each other, and I'll show you a couple ways that we can use that information that's really kind of handy. And what I'm going to show you now are a few slides, very few, because some of these presentations can go on for an hour. And again, sometimes the DG members like to come along. People who have a wind turbine like to come out and talk about it. We had an Earth Day thing at a school last year. I had two of my DG members out there talking about their wind turbines. So it's kind of an interesting process. So we'll start with a very abbreviated version of Welcome to the World of Alternative Energy. And we start with basically some background. Right now, Runestone Electric, for example, has 26 active interconnections between wind turbines and solar panels. And this is just one picture of one that's kind of unique. It's actually a mini wind farm. There are six turbines on this hill. They're 66 kW each. And in the full presentation, we go through a list of all the wind turbines, and we give names. We share that information. And the people that have these systems are more than willing to talk to others who might be interested in doing it. And we get into some of the history because we started about the time the law started. Our first DG system went up in 1979. And basically, that's one of the things we stress the most is do your homework. Talk to the people who have been there and done that, because almost always they're happy to share, and that's one of the key roles that the co-op can play, is making that connection between the people who have already done it. And these are just some pictures, and in the real presentation, we go through it in quite a bit of detail. We show our old newsletter articles. Notice the creative title, Blowing in the Wind. I was the editor of the newsletter at that time, and I have to apologize for that, but I thought it was clever. And
it is.
And the rest of it is the answer, Blowing in the Wind. I know it was silly, but this was one of the very first DG interconnects, and this one's got a great story. I know I have a limited time, but that tower that this wind turbine was put up on was built from salvage from a power line tower that had been knocked down in the power line protests of the 70s. Okay. So there's some colorful history here. And these presentations, like I say, they get long, but they can be interesting too. This is one of my favorite slides. This inverter, if you look carefully, the one that says 1970s is the actual inverter that was used in that one I just showed you. It's got about three components. And he replaced that turbine a couple of years ago with a modern one, and this is the inverter. This is the same device doing the same thing that did. I think a person could say that technology has come a little ways since then. So we have a lot we can talk about, but what we really focus on is the under 40 kW, the net energy billing that Director Grant talked about. Basically, we try to explain to them what the rates are. We pay the retail rate. Right now, ours is 9.2 cents, and we give a number of slides that focus on this. And the 40 kW is also intended to limit some of the cost shifting that we're inevitably going to talk about here. But we'll go into that in some deal. But ultimately, what net energy billing is using a utilities grid as the world's biggest battery. And this is the key component that we talk about. And we get into it in some detail. Most of you, I'm sure, are aware of what the process really is. But we will go through it from the generator to the disconnects, the emergency disconnects. And then this little bugger here, this little info meter, I will talk about a little bit more, because that's something that our co-op and a lot of other utilities require. But we will tell people what all's involved. We'll show them a picture of what it really looks like. This is actually, in real life, what all that stuff looks like. And then we explain to them in detail that what net energy billing means is that power flows in one direction, goes through one meter, and when power from their turbine is exceeding their use, it flows in the other direction. And then at the end of the month, you basically take the difference between the two, and you either get a bill or a check. And that takes a little discussion. People kind of struggle with the idea, but we spend as much time with it as needed. And back to that production or the info meter, this little guy here that I was just pointing out. Again, a lot of utilities require that, and that's him right there. And it's important because it's not required under law. It's not required under code. But it is important because that meter will deliver a reading back to the co-op every 27 hours. And basically, we have then open access to that customer and any other customer he wants to give access to. And it provides a utility-grade record for the production of the turbine. It doesn't say how much energy he bought or sold from us. That's not what this meter is for. This meter is for measuring how much that turbine actually produced. And if, for example, he is taking advantage of the federal production tax credit, which two or three of our customers are, he needs that information to be able to file for his tax credit at the end of the year. And it is also extremely important for equipment evaluation. And here's a good example of that. This turbine is a 10 kW turbine that we keep records on like we do on all of them. And you can see through here, if you can't read that number over there is 6. And remember, this is a 10 kW turbine. He is not producing what he should. So he comes to us and says, I don't think my system's working right. We look up the records. He takes this graph prior to this point to the vendor and says, here, this isn't what I bought. The vendor comes out, makes a couple changes, and all of a sudden he's up to 8. And if I would have put a little more into this, in the last few months, this same turbine is now up to 10. And if you're somebody who bought a wind turbine, it's very difficult for you to go back to the vendor and say, I don't think it's working right. Very often, the vendor will say, oh, that's how it's supposed to work, leave me alone. But if you're backed up with data like this, it's very difficult to say, oh, well, gee, it's supposed to put out 6. No, it's not. It's a 10. So those types of interactions take place more frequently than I really wish they would, but we've provided that data to a number of our DG members, and it's just one of the interactions that take place in kind of an ongoing basis between us, the co-op, and the DG customer. And ultimately, what we're going to focus on with our customers is to do your homework. We really would like them to spend time learning about this before they write a check that could be $30,000-$40,000, it could be $200,000 for one of these wind turbines. We really encourage them to spend some time looking into it, and this is where we get into the good, the bad, and the ugly. I've only got a couple slides here, but we spend more time on this in the real presentation, and this is the good. This is a turbine that's been out there for 10 years. He's been down for 1 month. Very reliable turbine. We'll give him the capacity factor. We'll tell him how much energy it's produced. We have the permission of that customer to share that data. Then there's the bad. This is kind of a funny picture because this is one another customer of mine walked out his door one morning, looked over the roof line, and found out that his wind turbine was on fire. Oh. If you look in the middle here, there's a little orange glob. It's actually burning. But that one, yeah, anything can happen. That one is not a real serious slide.
The slide on the left, the gentleman that had it for 10 years, yep. How long did it take for him to have that paid off?
Running about a 13.5% capacity factor. I would say his average revenue is $300 or $400 a month. He paid about $65,000. I can do the math on that really easy for you, Madam Chairman, if you like. Mm-hmm. That's not difficult. I don't have it right in my back pocket, but okay. The paybacks on these things are, and I'll show you a real one in a minute here. Okay. But yeah, those are the types of paybacks that we will calculate with permission, of course, of the customer. But you'd be amazed. The people that do this really do want to share. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a graph, the one I showed you about the KW. Occasionally I get these guys being competitive. And for example, when I get home, I have to put together a graph of 4 turbines. They're all the same brand, and they're competing with each other to see who can get the most production. So I will graph it out and show them. They're fun to work with. But anyway, back to the good, bad, and the ugly.
Senator Sparks?
Just one more question. I'd like you to keep moving on. It's been a good presentation. Mr. Hultman, can you give us an example when you talked about how did they get that increased, from the 6 to the 10 kilowatts?
In that case, it was a capacitor bank that they had not put into the actual inverter itself. It had the capability of running capacitance, and they were not running the capacitance before it went from 6 to 8. And then the 8 to 10 increase was actually done by installing a device that synchronizes the blade governors. So a lot of technical stuff can be done with these things to actually improve. And probably the worst example of this is we had a guy put up a 20 kW that was producing 4. And we brought the same information to the vendor. He'd forgotten to tighten the bolts on the springs that govern the blades. Well, that'll have a serious effect. But, again, having that data available made it easy for him to make that case.
Thank you.
Mr. Hultman.
Well, anyway, this is the ugly. And this is one that we really do focus on because this falls under the do-your-homework category. This customer bought this wind turbine. It's a 5kW, bought it off the Internet from a Canadian company, had no UL listings. When it arrived, it was an electrical nightmare. I thought Don Nemeth, the state electrical inspector, was going to have a heart attack. It didn't meet any code. And it cost a lot of money to get it up to code.
How much did it cost, Mr. Holdman?
I believe he's had probably a little over $15,000 in this one.
My.
And it ran for about 6 months from March 07 to October 07. The turbine melted down, literally catastrophic failure, and the vendor refused to honor the warranty, changed their name, and went about doing business.
Wow.
And the good news, though, is that the fellow who bought this has actually accompanied me out in the field to do presentations to a group to explain to people why it's so important that you do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
So a little good can come out of something really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kinds of things that we do keep stressing. And this is a slide that is sad. This is something that one of my customers brought to me about a year or two ago. And this is actually a financial performance analysis given out by a vendor. And you'll see Runestone Electric Association pays an average retail of 9.2 cents. Everything on there is, I'm sure, somewhat factual. But if you look at this carefully, what at the bottom line, this vendor says that this will have a six-year payback. And they base this on a production of 191,000 kilowatt hours a year. Now, if you do the math on this, that's a 54.6% capacity factor. If you're familiar with this, the biggest, most efficient wind turbines I know of have a real problem hitting 40. The best turbine I know of in our area is at 38, and that's a huge turbine down at the University of Minnesota Morris. An average capacity factor for a system like this is 15 to 20%. So what we are telling people is you need to, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. And then we will go in, Madam Chairman, these are actual economics that, again, our customers have agreed to share. We know exactly how much they paid for the system. The informational meter that we require to be installed tells us exactly how many kilowatt hours it produces. And this is over a 24-month period. This particular customer is interesting because it was a $44,000 system. He got a 30% rebate from the Federal Treasury and a 25% rebate from the USDA. So he ended up with about $23,000 out of pocket on this particular one, and that's about a 19.5-year payback. Now, this machine is a little bit underperforming. It's about a 9.5% capacity factor, which is low even for these, and he's working on that. But those are the kinds of transactions that kind of that have to be looked at if you're interested in investing your money in a system like this. And we go through benefits, obviously the free electricity part of it, net metering, environmental benefits, rebates. The economics, we kind of leave to the customer. We provide the data. We also look at the risks, be suspicious of production claims that look too good. Are they UL listed? Safety issues. We've run into some issues lately with just simple safety questions. Warranties. And again, the economics are something that the customer has to resolve. And we go through a number of resources. This is a little handout that I can give to all of you that we give out to our customers when we go to these kind of meetings. And this is the stuff it'll have in it. The state of Minnesota, the Department of Commerce has an excellent website, Windustry, American Wind Energy Association, and there's other links in this booklet. So basically what we see is the co-op's role is help our members make informed decisions. You know, don't be hustled by a hotshot salesman and help them evaluate that investment and provide them with good, credible, utility-grade data that they can use if they've got a production tax credit they have to file for or something like that. Now, the last point, though, is why are we concerned and what are the issues? And this speaks back to what Director Grant mentioned earlier. And what I've done here is put together a very simple scenario where a customer, and again, this is, you know, in some ways kind of a goal of distributed generation, is the ability to be able to offset all of your energy use. There are a number of ways to do that, and over the course of the next year or so, we'll be talking about extended rollover periods, increase the 40 kW. But the bottom line is that let's just assume for a moment that one of my average residential customers achieved a zero net energy over the period of whatever the rollover might be, maybe a year. What happens, and let's use a year just as an example, because if that happens, and if that customer was able to offset all of their own energy usage, they're going to pass on about $1,000 in annual costs. to the remaining co-op customers. And this is where our concern really kind of hits home. So those least able to afford a higher rate are going to pay more to benefit those who can afford to invest in DG.
Mr. Holtman, what are those costs?
The $1,000 is a very simple, really. Are you a co-op member by any chance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you get the annual report every year that has that pie chart where my dollar came from and where it went?
Yeah.
Almost all co-ops send that out. It's inevitable. And the one thing that you'll see is that where the dollar went. And usually 50 to 60% of that dollar goes to the wholesale power company to pay for the wholesale power. Okay. The other 40% is going to be the operational cost of the co-op. And then in that 50 to 60%, a share of that will also be fixed. So the 40% that's not wholesale power cost, and probably half of that 60% that is wholesale power cost. And I did the math on this one just this morning to make sure I'm right. And it turns out to be $998 actually in our case right now, because a fair share of the operation cost, actually almost all of the operation costs of the co-op, don't go away just because you don't buy power. And this is where it gets a little bit tricky, because if you look into a very simple process that Director Grant talked about, it's this buying and selling that I showed you earlier on the graph. You're still buying energy and selling energy all month long. And very unlikely that you would reduce your peak demand on our system. And in some cases, you could make a case that you would increase your peak demand on this system. So no matter what the rules may be and whatever we come up with, this is going to be a key element to distributed generation policy, and that is that a DG power producer continues to use our system. Their production, by definition, mostly wind and solar, is intermittent. So they're still going to have the same demands that they had prior to putting in DG as they will after they put in DG. So really, that's where the 40% on that graph doesn't go away. So you really can't credit the DG customer for that 40%, and you really can't credit them for the 50% of the... Now, if I was XL Energy or Otter Tail Power, this would be simpler, because I would be vertical, and I could put that one chart, and it would just be one little pie chart. But being a co-op, we have to factor in the fixed cost of the G&T, in my case, Great River Energy. So that number comes out to be just about 70%. And during the DER presentations earlier in November, this same number was presented by XL Energy and Minnesota Power. So that 70% is going to be very close, no matter if you're a co-op or a private utility. And those are the costs that are going to then be shifted. And that's the part of it. If they pay us nothing in kilowatt-hour cost, if at the end of that period they've offset their entire usage, they're still going to need the grid, and they're still going to have to be responsible in some fashion, because the costs of those fixed costs are embedded in the kilowatt-hour rate. So if they're basically not paying a kilowatt-hour rate, there will still be a small component, probably 10%, that you'll see. You have a fixed charge on your bill, right? Okay, that's part of the fixed cost, but a very small part. And so we've already taken that out of the calculation that I'm showing you now. But basically, most of the fixed cost of operating a co-op are embedded in the kilowatt-hour rate. And if you're not paying a kilowatt-hour rate, you're not paying for the operation of the utility. And if that happens, then those costs must be distributed back to the rest of the utility customers. So it's basically our position. Last slide. I'll make this quick.
Got a quick question.
Yes, Senator Howe. Excuse me, Mr.
Madam Chair, could you say, when you say zero cost, don't most co-ops charge a availability charge?
Correct.
And so is that, when you say, is that not factored in here somewhere too?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Holtman.
Okay. I factored that in. Actually, the cost, the total cost that is allocated to what we call the fixed part of our business would be about $1,200. The $200 that are taken off of that represents, in our case, a $17 a month fixed charge, mm-hmm. and that does go directly to the fixed cost. So we take that off, and that's where we come up with the $1,000 that's remaining.
That's
Senator
not,
Hill.
Madam Chair, that's not.
Well, I'm sorry.
That is not a that fixed charge is still being assessed. That's not a kilowatt charge. I mean, they may be getting credit for that, but that's still a fixed cost that's being accounted for. Correct.
They would still be paying that, Senator.
Okay.
And Madam Chairman.
So. What's the average, Madam Chair? What's the average electric availability charge on an annual basis?
Mr. Holtman,
Senator Hall and Madam Chair,
I get that right.
I think it's a wide range, and the range that I know of would be between $7 or $8 a month, and maybe 30, maybe 40. Help me out, guys. 40. I think there is a co-op in the state now that has 40.
25.
So yes, you're right, and that would have to be taken off. But we've already done that to come up with that $1,000 cost that remains after the fixed charge has been paid.
Mr. Holtman.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, right? You're doing great.
Okay, thank you.
No flogging allowed.
Okay.
You don't have to flog.
So anyway, our position is kind of simple, and it's very, very close to what Director Grant said, is that we need to assess the cost that would otherwise be shifted to those who can't. We view this as somewhat regressive, is that if you're shifting costs to those who can't afford DG, and those are going to be you know what the rural demographics are, a lot of low income, right. A lot of small business, dairies, and so forth.
Elderly.
We feel that it's a very regressive policy to actually shift costs to help benefit those who can afford to invest in DG and make the rest of the customers pay more. We feel that those who have net metering should be responsible to pay their own way. So.
Very good.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
You did great, Mr. Holtman. Seriously.
Thank you.
You did. We would love to have you come back. Wasn't that scary, was it?
I'm running.
Any other questions, members? Yeah, right.
I had to knock the mud off my boots.
Ingebrigtsen, yeah.
Madam Chairman, are there questions?
There is, I did have one. What was it? How much time and staff do you put into this DG? I mean, is it...
More than we should,
yeah.
Madam Chair.
Have you put a number to it and how FTEs?
I bet, Madam Chair, I bet I put in 15-20% of my time on this.
Really?
Now, to be fair, if somebody comes in and puts up a DG system and it requires engineering work and if it requires our linemen to be out there, in fairness to the current policy, we are allowed to charge that customer for any costs over and above the cost for normal electric service, and we do that.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody comes in, typically those costs are fairly low. There is an additional cost for metering a DG system. I know there's been discussion about how this can be done with one meter, but with the meters that we use, it can't be. So there is an additional cost. It's about $380, I think, for a second device to actually measure the reverse direction energy flow. But those are pretty minor costs. But if they need a bigger transformer, if they need engineering work, things like that, those costs are passed on to the DG customer as they should be, I believe.
And you would say that the interest in DG is increasing with your customers, or is it stable?
It's
or?
Very strong, Madam Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strong, but it's fairly stable right now. I haven't seen a great increase lately. But I would be concerned that major changes in the DG policy that might make it look more attractive. We have to be very careful to have all the pieces of the puzzle on the table. And Director Grant agrees with me on this. He just said the same thing, mm-hmm. is that we need both sides, both the cost that we pass along that we feel that should be the responsibility of the customer and the benefits, if those benefits can be quantified and identified. All of those pieces need to be on the table during the process.
That's a very good point.
Yep.
Everybody has to be to the table. Nice, steady hand. That's good.
Just the facts.
Thank you, Mr. Holtman.
Thank
very
you.
Nice. Any other questions? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, could you just answer, and maybe you did here and I missed it, but what's the exact number that you have on your, that you have people that are doing this?
Mr. Holtman.
I'm going to get this right. Senator Howe, Madam Chair. 26.
26.
Okay. 26. And that it's about 760 kW, so it's a fair amount. But we have that one little mini wind farm that's 396 kW all by itself, so that's kind of a unique installation.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, okay. And thanks so much for letting us have the opportunity to speak.
Oh, absolutely, it was a pleasure. All right, Mr. Hinkle, Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, welcome again, Mr. Hinkle. Senator Minson's our welcome committee. He can't leave. He's our welcome committee. Come back here. Mr. Hinkle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Lynn Hinkle. I'm policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. I'm delighted to be here to talk briefly about our position in relation to distributed energy generation and its many benefits. I'm going to run through a pretty high-level description of what we believe are the key, the essential benefits of distributed generation, and then share with you our thoughts as an association about what we think are the key next steps in moving forward with the deployment of solar and distributed generation generally. To the point of distributed energy generation and its benefits, we believe that diversity of fuel types and sites improves security and energy independence. Number two, distributed generation can and frequently does improve grid reliability. Three, on-site energy, particularly solar, reduces costs for distribution, transmission, and peaker capacity. DG, distributed generation, is part of energy's future for developing what's generally called smart grid and electric vehicle fueling. It's not just a question of what is going to happen right at that site. It has implications far beyond just the immediate installation of solar or distributed generation. Lastly, before I get into talking about our position, DG is jobs and distributed economic development. And I believe some of you have taken advantage of the Brookings Institute recent paper on using state energy funds to consciously promote economic development, and speaks very eloquently to the opportunities that can come from being able to target those funds more directly for the production of jobs. Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association participated in the activities of DER, distributed generation workshops throughout the fall. And at the conclusion of those, we convened two meetings ourselves. We reviewed each of the 7 points of the DER-DG summary and opted to focus on those elements we believe are essential to developing solar energy as part of distributed energy in Minnesota. Short of consensus, these points do express majority agreement from all sectors of MNSEA's membership base. Number one, net metering cap size to load. Net metering capacity for non-residential sites, in our view, may be sized to load up to the highest peak demand for the site over the previous 3-year period, or in the case of new construction or repurposing, the highest projected peak demand for the next 12 months. Number two, rollover of credits with an annual true-up. Customer generators would be credited in dollars and cents any net excess in kilowatt hours production from the generating facility that exceeds the customer generator's on-site consumption. Credits will be applied to subsequent billing periods to offset the customer's consumption in those billing periods and trued up annually. It's worth noting that we didn't take a position on how that gets compensated. Number three, distribution benefits. New distributed generator capacity shall be prioritized according to utility system-wide assessment of benefits to distribution networks and overall optimization of the grid. And that's actually probably a subset of our concluding recommendation, which is that we proceed with an analysis of DG, distributed generation, solar costs, and benefits. There's been quite a bit of discussion about this from both the previous three speakers, and we'll just add our voice in affirming that DER should engage utilities and other stakeholders in a study modeled after studies such as the Arizona Public Service, APS, titled Distributed Renewable Energy Operating Impacts and Valuation Studies, that quantifies system costs and benefits of distributed solar generation at different levels of penetration. This is really, at least in the area of energy policy, a seminal study that really helps, I think, people understand both the cost, which we can't minimize, the fixed costs that have been talked about, but as Deputy Commissioner Grant indicated, frequently the benefits that I think we've all anecdotally believed are a part of what solar and distributed energy can represent seldom find their way into the equation. And we think it's time for that to be quantified, and we think once that's done, we've got a real opportunity to determine what the real impact is on ratepayers, but beyond that, what the real economic benefit, what the real job-producing benefits are for solar and distributed energy generation in our state. And with that, I'll conclude and look forward to questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Hinkle.
Answered all the questions.
You did. You did great. Thank you. I think we'll have Ms. Laura McCartan, the Regional Vice President for Xcel, and Lauren Lautick come up at the same time. Thank you both for being here. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Laura McCartan. I'm Regional Vice President with Xcel Energy. Are we going to – do we do it – do you want us to do this kind of sequentially? I'll go ahead and then I'll toss it over to Lauren. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address the committee here today about distributed generation. We have indeed seen a growing interest on the part of our customers, stakeholders, and policymakers in an expanded role of distributed generation in the electric grid. So we appreciate being part of this discussion, and we certainly want to be part of a solution that enables customer choice and to proceed in a sensible and sustainable way. We agree that we need to design a set of rules that will maintain what we need from today's grid as we develop the grid of the future. No one of us can predict exactly how this electric grid will evolve or at what pace, but working together with a comprehensive approach, we can ensure that the proper foundation is laid. If we don't take this approach, on the other hand, the outcome could be quite different from the intended direction. We could find ourselves ending up with significant and unjustifiable cross-subsidization of costs by customers of choices of the few paid for by the many, distortions to the market for energy resources, and avoidable conflict when we find ourselves having to fix the unintended consequences. In addition to the need to lay the proper foundation for significant changes, there are also a couple of other issues that need to be addressed in the larger discussion of distributed generation. One concern you've already heard about, and that is the inherent subsidization with the net metering rate, as it is today, and especially if this rate is greatly expanded, as has been discussed at times. Another concern is to understand how to best integrate upfront incentives that promote distributed generation, along with how to integrate that into the overall picture. So let me talk briefly to each of these, and starting with the net metering rate. You've heard quite a bit about that already, so I'll try not to be too repetitive here. But as you've heard, this rate that's used for distributed generation does not recover from the customers who use it all of the costs that utilities actually incur to serve that customer. And as you've heard, those are the costs of the grid. Everything that is connected to the wire that comes from that customer's facility that connects to the grid, the poles and the wires and the substations that are there so that we can deliver electricity to that customer when their distributed generation facility isn't producing electricity, either the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing, for example. Instead, this customer's, any particular distributed generation customer's share of those costs is instead shifted to the rest of the customers, and that's true for an investor-owned utility as well. So this is indeed a hidden subsidization for distributed generation, and this point is made in a recent study, the MIT study on the future of the electric grid, which concluded that net metering policies provide an implicit subsidy to distributed generation, and this subsidy will grow as the size and number of distributed generation systems also grow. So it causes different customers to be treated. It causes different treatment among customers and can be also an additional burden to low-income customers. The total amount being subsidized will grow as the number of installations grows, and also if the net metering, if the application of that is expanded so that larger installations can take advantage of that. And there has been some discussion to increase the size from a 40 kW limit to a 2,000 kW limit. So that's a significant increase. And there are implications of that that we need to understand. And we've actually seen how this can play out. XL Energy also serves in Colorado and in the Denver area. There is a lot of rooftop solar installed there. In fact, we have about 110 megawatts of solar installed in Colorado versus about 5 megawatts here in Minnesota. There's also a net metering rate very similar in use in Colorado. And we've seen that the ongoing subsidy between customers due to the net metering rate and due to the large number of solar installations is becoming quite significant. We've also found that as we are trying to get the rules right now, there are a lot of people who have already made investments based upon an understanding or an assumption that they have this ongoing rate, and so it's much more difficult at this point to try to get the rules right as a phrasing that we continue to keep going back to. With this experience, we strongly believe that further distorting the rate paid by distributed generation would not make sense. Instead, let's develop a fair rate and then apply the incentives that policymakers agree they want to have in place to promote the energy policies that are desired. This approach has the merit of being transparent and also can be more easily adjusted as market conditions warrant. For example, if the cost of an energy source continues to reduce, as we've seen with a lot of the emerging energy technologies, then perhaps the subsidies or the incentives should also move in the same direction. And just another data point here, a recent government lab survey of photovoltaic solar costs, showed that state and utility subsidies across the nation on average have dropped from an after-tax average of more than $4 per watt to less than $2 per watt in 2010. We think that this would be an appropriate thing for Minnesota as well to maintain a proper balance with program incentives and market costs. Madam Chair, we think that the Department of Energy Resources has started an important discussion with these stakeholder meetings that you've heard about and an ongoing process to sort through this complex set of policies and statutes. And we look forward to continuing a collaborative effort with the department and other stakeholders in order to foster a distributed generation system that grows sensibly and that is solidly backed up by the existing facilities which have served our state well. The concerns I have noted are ones that can and should be addressed in a comprehensive fashion to create a path forward that can be successful for all stakeholders involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCartan. Can you go back to, again, the appropriate policies? You mentioned the costs and the market. Can you just get into that a little bit more? What is needed to make this work?
Madam Chair, yes. I think the first thing would be to try to get that fundamental foundation of the rate that is paid by any type of customer, and we're talking about distributed generation customers here, get that to be correct. And we've talked about the fact that there is a built-in subsidy there. So first, let's get the foundation correct. Then, as policymakers such as yourselves or others decide that there's a certain energy policy that you want to pursue, and if that includes incenting certain types of energy uses, then make those incentives transparent and make them something that you can adjust over time if they're no longer needed. If they're needed to kickstart a technology, get it out in the market, but then as that technology becomes cost competitive, then it seems to make sense to move in, you know, make that adjustment. Mm-hmm. That was my point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Any questions? Ms. McCartan. Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carton, could you, Mr. Holtman said that it costs $1,000 for each member. Do you have a cost for Excel by chance?
Ms. McCartan.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I don't have the exact number, but would be willing to give that to you. But it is roughly that 70% number is about the percentage of the costs that are the fixed cost of the poles and wires and the substations and so forth that are needed to deliver energy. And so it doesn't include, well, it's about 70%, so we can follow up and get that number.
That'd be great. That'd be great. Okay. Questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. McCartan. Mr. Lautig, how are you doing?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lauren Lautig of Otter Tail Power Company. The investor-owned electric utilities have been in a conversation about this hearing throughout the week, so I together with Minnesota Power and Xcel, would like to reinforce Ms. McCartan's points made, and that were, I might add, effectively made by Mr. Haltman of Runestone Electric as well. The first being that net metering does lead to a significant and unjustifiable cross-subsidization by most customers for the choices of a few. And then because of this subsidization, net metering policies provide an implicit subsidy to distributed generation. And this subsidy only increases as the size of the DG system increases and as more systems are installed, and that's what's been discussed in the meetings we've had together this fall. I'd like to address specifically one of the questions on the chair's list that was provided, and that's question number one. And if I might paraphrase, what are the goals of promoting distributed generation applications among utility customers? It's been suggested by some that there is an enhanced reliability. I think if we were talking about fossil fuel-based distributed generation systems, there might be some argument that this is possible. In fact, in my early utility career, I actually went out and sold those kinds of systems to customers, primarily hospitals and nursing homes, and in some cases colleges, so that they could go off our system when we had peaks in our system demand. So fossil fuel-based distributed generation systems can be useful for reliability purposes. However, we're talking here primarily about renewable systems that are intermittent, specifically wind and solar, and these are those that are net metered and that are less than 40 kilowatts by current statute. A second argument that's advanced is that possibly there's an overall cost reduction, but as my two previous counterparts have offered, there is a fixed system cost that's not contributed to by customers who are successfully using net metering. Those costs remain the same. The utility has to maintain a full capacity system for all of those customers as well. I think the real probably rationale for why we would promote distributed generation among customers is probably related more to something that looks like local self-reliance. And I'm certainly not saying that that's a bad goal. However, for anyone who's old enough, and I'm not quite, to have lived through the 40s and 50s and remembers the what we would call an islanded electric system that we had in the old days, where the city of Fergus Falls would be on its own and the city of Alexandria would be on its own, and then folks who were on farms would be kind of on their own. There wasn't an interconnected electric system in the way that we understand it today. And so outages were frequent and expected, and sometimes they lasted a long time. When we interconnected all of these entities with the electric grid in the 60s and 70s, it changed everyone's lives substantially. And in fact, there's an organization that's called the National Academy of Engineering, which is part of the larger national academies, the National Academy of Science. And the National Academy of Engineering listed what they believed to be the greatest engineering achievements of the 20th century. And just to start from near the bottom of the list, number 16 was health technologies. Number 13 was the internet. Number 11 was highways. Number 8 was the computer. Number 3 was the airplane. Number 2 was the automobile. And the greatest achievement of the 20th century, according to the National Academy of Engineering, is in fact the electrification of America. That is the provision of reliable electricity to every corner of the country where it's needed. This was what provided the opportunity for success in all other areas of engineering, according to NAE. From my own personal experience, I live about 7 miles outside of Fergus Falls, and I'm a member of Lake Region Electric Cooperative. And Lake Region is part of the interconnected electric grid, and it's quite reliable for me. In fact, we only have one or two outages a year. They're very brief, and I do not even have a generator installed on my rural location. So I have that much faith in the electric system. So that concludes my comments, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for letting me testify.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Lautock. Any questions for either one of them? My question is for Director Grant. Director Grant, is there anything that you'd like to respond to that you heard today that was perhaps? Thank you very much, you two. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, and Madam Chair,
but just a kind of a general idea. And
the answer is really no. I mean, nothing here other testifiers spoke of are a surprise. These were all points that were made in the comments that we received, and these are all issues that we intend to take a closer look at as we study this issue further and if appropriate, bring back recommendations to you as hopefully as soon as next year.
Mm-hmm. So, Director Gant, how would you, I mean, like I said, I don't want to put you on the spot, but the fixed cost, how would you address that? That seems to be significant.
Well, Madam Chair, we haven't had a chance to review those cost estimates independently, so I'm really not going to comment on those at this point. As I said, I think we want to take a fair look at both the costs and benefits of distributed generation. And you know, there is a point at which, too, that we make certain energy policy decisions that do involve customers paying as part of a community of consumers for certain resources. And I'm not saying that that's the road we're going down here, but that's certainly always a feature of energy policy discussions.
Well, I thought it was very interesting today, and I really appreciate everybody's involvement and participation. And I wish you luck on the study and the stakeholder group. You know where to go if anybody would like to get involved, Mr. Holtman.
Sure he'll be
and
here.
I look forward to hearing the conclusion of your study.
Thanks so much.
Anything else? Anybody else has anything to say? No? Okay, next Tuesday we're going to have an update from the Governor Dayton's task force on the broadband, finishing up our telecommunications work. Next Thursday we're going to have a draft on the Renewable Development Fund going forward. So we'll have some testimony and talk about that piece of legislation going forward. We have to deal with that. The 23rd is our hearing on natural gas industry. And Senator Magnus, we were hoping to invite your committee to that. So we'll be talking to you about that. The guest speaker is Chris McGill from the Natural Gas Association. So pretty impressive speaker there. And from there, we have some ISO and some hearings on some bills that have coming in. But any comments, any further comments, ideas? With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.